today on the Monocle Weekly Edition 88, we'll be getting a roundup on the week's events in Libya.
One saw very much in what protesters were saying, their willingness to identify with each other and give support. That kind of support reflects a positive nationalism, and that exists over and above clan lines, tribal lines.
That was Richard Baltrop, Africa expert at the think tank Oxford Analytica. And we'll also be finding out which companies and countries are the biggest arms producers in the world following a new ranking published this week by CIPRI.
If you look at the list as such, out of the 100 companies, 45 are American. And if you look at the kind of services that have been provided, they have been related to field operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we have a linkage there.
That was Daniel Nord, Deputy Director of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. And later in the program, we'll be talking to business guru Guy Kawasaki about his new book, Enchantment, The Art of Changing Hearts, Minds, and Actions.
Three pillars of enchantment are likability, trustworthiness, and a great product or service. Those are the three pillars. You need to have some element of all three, but every company has a different level of each.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, February 27th, 2011. And you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London with me, Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, Robert Bound, and also because there's been some rather momentous things happening in North Africa this week. Also, Steve Bloomfield is here, our foreign editor.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Very good, thank you.
Good.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Good.
Have you guys all had a good week off? 2 weeks off?
What do you mean 2 weeks off? In what sense have been 2 weeks off? Just because you were
I had to anchor the show with Hugo MacDonald in Seoul last week.
You make that sound like it was a sort of a hardship.
It was a hardship.
Is Hugo's quite a good anchorman, is he not?
Yeah, he's a good wingman.
Is he?
Yeah, we had Bernie Cho.
Yeah, Bernie's good.
Bernie is very good. I think when we get our round-the-clock radio operation up and running, we need the Soul Sounds with Bernie Cho every week.
Yeah, he's always good. Got batteries in his clock.
Always.
That sounds like it sounds ruder than it's meant to be, doesn't it? Paul, but if Bernie's listening.
I don't know how his wife Eunice would feel about that. I think she'd probably feel quite good about it, in fact.
She'd be, everyone's happy when their husband's got batteries in the clock.
But it makes perfect sense. The radio station where we recorded last week's show is, it's part owned by the city of Seoul. And it's, you know, it's like a 5 or 6 story building. And they said, oh, well, I was talking to people later. So, you know, oh, you're at the studios for TBS. And they said, that's the traffic broadcasting system or something. And a city like Seoul does need a 5-story traffic radio station because
no one knows where they're going.
No one knows where they're going. I was in the car for 90 minutes stressing out on the way to studio. People storming out of our small booth. Anyway, it was fine.
I like the fact that where all the radio stations are, we've been around the world, that they're kind of bits of clues to kind of what their cultures are like.
It's true.
So you turn up and...
Anyway, did you miss me?
We did miss you lots.
Okay, good.
Because, well, we got to have a bit of a run at the new office.
You did. I'm sorry that I missed the move-in.
Yeah, I bet you missed
all that confusion over whose box is this and hang on,
where does it
where's
go?
Where's my laptop?
Are you sure that your box 88137? It was quite a military operation.
It was amazing, actually. It was strange on the very last day in Boston Place because at 4 o'clock there was literally a kind of, you know, we needed to kind of catch up with the removal guy. So it was literally a message that went out saying, please pack up your desk, but not just take the paper off, take the legs off it and
just
turn it upside down.
It's not a new problem getting a message out in the new building, is it?
No, because you seem to have got some magic button that kind of blares your messages to every single person.
You missed it, right? I've got building-wide intercom now.
Oh, God.
Because email is so old. Who needs instant messaging? We just pick up the damn phone, and it's like being in a Walmart or something. You can just sort of page everyone at once.
Well, that's quite a good that's quite a good if Big Brother-ish attitude to...
Yeah.
I like that.
It's a trick I learned from Mickey Drexler at J. Crew.
I thought so. I thought he had a kind of like, yeah.
The acoustics
over there
aren't
and,
quite
over there
right
and,
on
yeah.
it just yet, though.
No,
but
they're
there's
not.
There's a kind of a... Oh, that was Tyler. Did you say my name? What?
Yeah, we need to maybe base it up a little bit. Just like this program. Maybe Chris can sort of run the dials on the intercom system.
Do you want to be more bassy?
I think so.
Hi.
Hi, this is Tyler Tannoy.
Now, this is a question for all of you. With the events as they've been unfolding in Libya over the past week, what have been your news outlets of choice? I know we don't have a TV in the office. It's a trick question. TV not installed yet. TVs.
Yeah, so I've been online and I've been using Reuters, which they seem to get some stuff that other people don't have. Al Jazeera, I've liked for TV, and especially when I've gone home, Al Jazeera seems to have reasonably good stuff. The BBC, actually online for kind of UK kind of outlets, they seem to be being very slow at kind of getting stuff up. And the BBC is always a bit disappointing online. Mm. What's strange is, of course, everyone's been kind of cautious about sending their kind of reporters in. So it's been very piecemeal what's coming out. And it's been a bit of a disappointing revolution so far. You know, in the sense of news coverage, it took a long time to get the good stuff out.
And do you think it's good or bad? I throw this out to all of you. When you go to the BBC's website and then you let's say switch on to the World Today on the World Service or you're watching TV, do you want not consistency in message? Of course, the message has to be the same. But would you prefer to have all of the same stories and then they're just repackaged in the voice of someone else or getting video image? Or not, because I think I almost feel that the BBC website leads the news agenda now, because in fact, there's no surprises when you turn on any other bulletins. Like, I almost think that shouldn't the programmes almost be fighting for the stories as well?
Well, I think also the BBC's got a problem with this online content in that a lot of it's not very good.
A lot of spelling mistakes.
It's just...
I mean, I'm not saying that we get it right every issue either, but...
But it's just the quality isn't as good as, you know, as the World Service isn't as good as their TV packages. And I think that's partly because it's still seen for a lot of correspondents as, oh, well, I'll do the radio, I'll do the two-way on TV, we'll do the package, oh, and I'll bash out 400 words for online. And
don't forget to tweet.
Yeah, and exactly, while they're, you know, tweeting and blogging and so on as well. So I think actually their online content, although it's big and widely read all over the world, isn't quite as strong as it should be. Mm. I mean, one of the interesting things about what's been happening in Libya in terms of how news has been getting out until I think sort of the middle of this week when journalists started to get in was, you know, how actually Twitter was quite useful and how in Egypt Twitter and Facebook have been used to help the protesters get together. But then journalists got the story out. Here it's been used as a way of getting the story out in a very piecemeal way, because that's the only way to have got it.
Rob, I'm not sure if you're watching Al Jazeera, but it's, and it'd be interesting to get everyone's view on this, because on Al Jazeera they've been offering up, of course, proxy servers, you know, where you can send your stories, and likewise, you know, with special Twitter accounts, etc. And I'm wondering, what do you think about that type of advocacy, where in many ways the news organization is also the facilitator, you know, in so many ways. Now they go to their sort of web desk and they're really making these appeals. Here's how you can get your story to us. Is that what a modern news organization should be doing?
I guess they haven't got a huge amount of choice, and they haven't in Libya over the last week and a half. They haven't had choice, but it's obviously something they've learnt works, or learnt, you know, gives them a lot of stuff from which to choose, or gives them a lot of unedited stuff, and then they present it as unedited stuff, which is easy for them. But I guess in this revolution, they haven't had much choice, which is sort of interesting. I've enjoyed the radio more than any TV. I think the radio's really been wonderful. And I remember listening right in the first days of the Libyan sort of crisis, revolution, call it what you will, some, you know, voices, really sort of desperate voices came over the radio. You know, it's something that works for radio that hasn't worked for TV because there haven't been good enough images.
No, I mean, that's where it falls down slightly, doesn't it, Andrew? Because, you know, sometimes, you know, when they just have to well, it's a TV network and you've only got, you know, a map and they've highlighted Benghazi, and then the best they can do is a phoner. Yeah. You're a little bit let down.
Yeah, which is strange because, as you say, on radio, I've heard, you know, radio interviews this week with, you know, a British worker in a kind of encampment 3 miles south of Benghazi for oil workers. And actually him just being on the phone and talking from there was actually, you know, a rich and colourful experience on radio. But of course, on TV, that was a slightly kind of dead experience. Mm.
Well, for a take on where things might end up in Libya and, of course, across North Africa in general, we're joined on the line by Richard Baltrop, an Africa expert at the think tank Oxford Analytica. He joins on the line from Oxford. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
I guess to start, just given this is it has been a very fast-moving story, it will continue to be. I know you're probably not sitting in front of a crystal ball up in Oxford, but from your position, how does this unfold, do you think, over the weeks to come?
I have been optimistic when I've been trying to look into the future. I tend to look at the examples of Tunisia and Egypt and see the ways in which those involved in the popular uprisings have been able to continue their self-organization after the collapse of the regimes or the flight of the incumbent presidents. So that gives one reason to be optimistic.
I mean, just certainly from the side of, or at least the bureaucratic side of Libya, even, you know, earlier in the week, we had one of our correspondents was you know, was down at the embassy in London and said it was quite remarkable how, you know, the embassy itself was so divided that, you know, you had, you know, one side, of course, you know, very pro for everything that was happening. And of course, you know, also another side of hardliners as well. So, you know, if you're looking at a divided bureaucracy, you know, how does that settle down or how does it right itself?
With considerable difficulty. It's right to say that there's probably a divided bureaucracy. There are, in the Revolutionary Committees movement in Libya, there will be people who have more blood on their hands or who have been strongly involved in more abuses rather than less in the past. And then there will be people who are further down the food chain, or in some cases who are sort of more senior officials but who have managed to avoid great implication. So when one looks, for example, at Iraq after 2003, the Iraqis found ways to accept some former members of the Ba'ath Party continuing to play a role in society and in government. And in Libya, one's been seeing then in the past few days how quickly many functionaries, many bureaucrats are wanting to put themselves on the positive side.
It's Andrew here. I just wanted to ask a question, which is that a lot of talk has been about this kind of clan element within Libya, and both Gaddafi's are kind of saying that the country will fall into civil war, and actually lots of critics outside the country saying that it is actually more, you know, more prone to civil strife after this revolution than, say, Egypt was or Tunisia. Do you think that is true? Do you think it is a country that could fracture and could split in along clan lines?
No, I don't. It is, in absolute terms, possible, but it's a very small possibility. That the fault lines or the divisions that exist because of tribal affiliation or geographic divisions between eastern Libya and western Libya, for example, the significance of those generally get overstated by, particularly by people from outside analysing the country. And one has perhaps seen this during the Libyan uprising in the past 2 weeks, that Libyans have invoked national identity. They've invoked Libya. And then after the east of the country fell and protests were still escalating in the west and in Tripoli, one saw very much in what protesters were saying their willingness to identify with each other and give support. So it was people in Tripoli wanting to say, we will stand with you in Benghazi and we will follow you, and people in Benghazi voicing their support for people in Tripoli as well. That kind of support reflects a positive nationalism, and that exists over and above clan lines, tribal lines. Certainly, clan lines and tribal lines, all the same, are important for providing leadership and voice to people's demands and for the kind of organisation of people that will be needed after the collapse of the regime.
This is Steve here. This crisis seems to have been somewhat easier for the West to deal with, in that they can be as pro-democracy as they want in their statements, because none of them really like Gaddafi. There's been none of the umming and ahhing that there was with Ben Ali and Mubarak. I mean, do you think the West is responding in the right way, or does it even really matter how the West responds?
Tough question. I feel it does matter how the West responds. The West is viewed in mixed ways, often with ambivalence in the Arab world, and let's be particular within Libya. And Libyans involved in the uprising and watching it have been voicing sentiments of hope or expectations that the outside world will do more for Libya, the outside world including Europe, United States, United Nations. And then occasionally one has seen glimpses of the other side of that expectation, expressions of a sense of betrayal or a sense of betrayal in the past, sometimes in inconsistent or contradictory lines of thinking that are held by individuals, but who have lived under Gaddafi for nearly 42 years and have tried to find ways of explaining how has this exceptional autocrat or dictator remained in power. And sometimes out of despair, some Libyans may believe that he has been, or argue that he's been, backed in significant ways by Western governments. Whether it's coherent or not, that expression or that feeling may be voiced.
Richard, hi, this is Rob. I wondered who the contenders are. In the West, we're used to our politicians getting younger and more media friendly, and in the Middle East, everybody's been a sort of an absolutist old man. Does it look like the people that might be in contention for succession, are they a younger breed?
No individuals from the opposition have had a high profile during the past decade. The opposition in Libya was so suppressed political parties have been illegal in Libya, basically since the time Gaddafi came to power. And opposition movements, organized movements, have been repressed to the point of near obliteration, but they've organized. However, there are no high-profile individuals, and external attention and some attention within Libya focused during the past 9 years on Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, Colonel Gaddafi's most internationally media-friendly son, the best educated of them. But he now has no future, or it's very hard to conceive of a way he could have a future in Libya.
Great. Richard Braltrup from Oxford Analytica, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Andrew, when you asked the question about just, you know, what happens with the tribalism and, you know, and I think, you know, certainly earlier in the week you heard people saying, well, do you end up, you know, potentially, you know, with a Libya that that might be sort of divided into cantons and, you know, a place which is going to be incredibly sort of, you know, factionalized. Interesting that he says, you know, it's not going to go that way. Everyone's sort of rallying, you know, around the green flag. I know you didn't want to sort of needle him on it too much. But do you still think it could go that way, that, you know, that Benghazi, you know, does become its own city state and you know, and Tripoli becomes something very different?
It certainly seems that the country does have a lot of fiefdoms, and that these kind of clan elders are actually quite important in deciding what's happened, really, and that's why some of the kind of the ministers have defected, because they belong to certain clans or those old alliances have suddenly broken down. It would be interesting. It would be great to see that the country could hold together. But what was interesting is, I think one of the funny things is during the week seeing, you know, the return to the old royalist flag. There's so many people had these flags, obviously, in the backs of their wardrobes, ready to run up a flagpole. It was extraordinary that lots of people were obviously waiting for this day, that there was a kind of nascent kind of old school nationalism waiting to kind of sweep Gaddafi out of the way. So it was intriguing that so many people had that flag ready to kind of just kind of say, look, actually we'll stand behind this in the future.
Not to mention that we've got the portrait in this issue as well. We have you know, part of the royal family in our story about, you know, leaders and former royalty in exile. And I have to say that the Libyan princess that we photographed in Knightsbridge, I mean, she would be perfect for the part.
Yeah, she'd be a good emblem for us. And interestingly, you know, I know you've been there as well, Tyler, but when I went to Libya on holiday, as it was a few years ago, and it was amazing being there to see this very kind of, just such a strange country, you know, that where advertising was banned, where there was no, literally it was illegal to have any advertising except for images of Gaddafi. But one of my favourite things was seeing those demonstrations in Green Square. Was there's a wonderful museum off Green Square of kind of Roman antiquities and kind of the amazing kind of, you know, heritage of the region. But parked in the middle of it is an old Volkswagen Beetle, which is the Volkswagen Beetle that Gaddafi went around the country kind of getting people to kind of join the revolution in the first place. And it's parked there as, you know, literally against all this kind of Roman backdrop to say, look, you know, here's my chariot. This is the thing that kind of got me around the nation.
And that was shown as well when he did his rather odd speech, and the night before he'd done his even slightly more bizarre
appearance out of the
strangest car I've ever seen.
Yeah,
in my life.
I mean, I couldn't tell what kind of vehicle.
A massive white umbrella. Yeah. And it was, and the house he was outside of was the house that was bombed by the Americans in 1986. So, I mean, that was part of his sort of, hey, look, I am still in Tripoli. But the fact that he was making speeches from there, that he still sort of, you know, uses that as well, is sort of a reminder that, you know, he sees himself as not as a president or a king or in any sort of leader in that sense, but as, you know, the revolution guy,
yeah,
you know, brother leader of the revolution.
It'll be interesting, you know, when or if it happens, you know, the memoirs of the people who were part of the inner court, because I wondered that moment. Well, look, I'm in Libya. I'm not in bloody Venezuela. And was that sort of him standing, you know, standing up in the middle of the tent and sort of storming out and saying, let's get into the crazy car, get the umbrella and put my coat on, and, you know, and rallying state television around, you know, to make this announcement? Or do you think someone sort of saying, you know, no, you need to sort of, get up now? I mean, you know, is there a team of advisors around him?
I can't imagine. Can you imagine? Yeah. Maybe it's someone else's fault. Maybe he's a phenomenally normal man. He's just a man. He's just trying to be, you know, an everyman president like anybody else. And he's got a team of crazed advisors that are telling him to put the umbrella up. Always put the umbrella up, Colonel.
I was going to say, the interview I want to read is, I was Gaddafi's stylist. Because
I was going to say as well.
He's had some amazing looks over the last week.
Brilliant. Yeah, I was going to say my favourite was, and I think it was sort of, you know, a grand, you know, African gathering in Tripoli a few years ago, where he had the safari sorry outfit, which looked like he'd actually called someone in Helsinki at Marimekko to make it for him, because with these perfectly sort of, you know, bright green African continents all over it, and you thought, yeah, this is actually looks like a child's play suit that someone could have worn in the summers of Finland in the 1950s.
What there'll hopefully be is a new Kapuscinski who will be able to do a similar book to what he did with Haile Selassie, the Emperor, where he goes around and he interviews everyone who basically worked for Haile Selassie, from, you know, the guy whose job it was to provide the cushion underneath his feet whenever he, you know, was sat down at a table, to, you know, his chief of intelligence. So that's the book to write.
Well, wherever it goes, I mean, hopefully, you know, not just the tents, but the palaces and everything else aren't torched, because you have to almost think that, you know, a lot was lost, you know, in Tunisia, and certainly, you know, not on the same scale as I think what will be found in Libya, because, you know, if they're going to be looking for tourism dollars in short term, you could definitely, there's a Disney management contract in there for sure. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're in London. We're back in a moment. Back with the Monocle Weekly here in London. This week, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, released its annual ranking of the top 100 arms-producing companies around the world. With defense spending budgets having been slashed across the globe, which companies and countries top the list, and what does the ranking tell us about the current state of the global arms industry? Daniel Nord is deputy director of SIPRI, and he joins us now on the line from Stockholm to tell us more. Hello, Daniel.
Hi.
I wanted to start, when you look at this ranking of the 100 arms-producing companies and, of course, the nations attached, a list like this, is one just for public awareness? Is it a shame list? Is it a reminder to think that, yes, America has, you know, a wonderful national brand, but, ladies and gentlemen, did you notice that they're also the world's biggest arms-producing nation? What is the mission, particularly when you're looking at a naming by corporate example?
Well, from our point of view, is basically that we would like to make this data available, because it is hard to find it. But then it's actually used by both the industry, is using it as a way of, you know, keeping track of competition and where they still are, and where they themselves are. And also, of course, the disarmament groups are also using this as a way of keeping track, but also, to some extent, name and shame. But Cyprus' role is neither. It's neither naming or shaming, nor serving the industry. We just make the data available.
Mm. I mean, you make a caveat in this that, you know, of course, the Chinese are big players and are certainly very active in the international arms bazaar, but you make a note that, you know, some are not included in the ranking. You know, likewise, if you look at nations, you know, like Kazakhstan, the Ukraine, is it just because you simply cannot get an accurate enough view that it's just, you know, things are simply too opaque?
Yeah, with regard to China, that's certainly so. It's most likely the main Chinese companies would be on the top 100, perhaps, you know, on the top 50 list. But there's simply not credible or sufficiently accurate data available, so it makes it impossible to include them. With regard to Kazakhstan and Ukraine, there are companies there which might appear on the top 100 list, but it's not as certain as the Chinese companies.
Mm. You know, have you seen, and I don't want to sort of treat this like music charts, but in terms of sort of new entries, and again, I mean, this is not something that can happen overnight, but, you know, whether we're talking, you know, decade or half decade, new players, you know, emerging, you know, on the list, you know, and in a serious scale as well, that simply weren't there before.
Well, the trends of the last couple of years has been that as a company providing military services or service to the military, they have had a steady increase. And that's the segment which has grown over the last couple of years, providing logistics in the war zone, providing intelligence in the war zone, those kind of things. That has gone up. And that's also included in our data.
Mm.
And that's of course has to do with the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, given the fact that the US is withdrawing from Iraq, but there might be a change there with regard to the military services sector. But currently, and over the last 10 years, more or less, that has been a steadily growing sector.
Mm. So if we look at sort of the headline, you know, arms producing companies. doesn't necessarily mean that we're talking about that everyone has to be building guidance systems for advanced missile systems. It could also be people who are, as you said, are dealing with logistics, putting personnel, on the ground, all of the outsourcing that we hear about at the moment. That is also included in this list.
That's included in the list if it's carried out in what I would call a battle zone. Not that type of operation if it's carried out in peace basis, also peacetime basis, such as continental USA or in Western Europe or those kind of places. But if it's done in Iraq, in Afghanistan, or if in other places where there's conflict, yes, then it is included.
Daniel, hi, this is Steve. There's been a bit of embarrassment over the past few weeks from, among some Western countries when it's been revealed that they've sold weapons to countries which have then started using it on their own people, whether that's in Libya or Bahrain. Do you think this could lead in the future to more concerns about selling arms to autocratic regimes, or certainly amongst Western companies?
Arms-producing companies in Western Europe, for instance, they have to operate on a smaller market. I mean, the Western European market is not growing as the American market is growing. So they will have to establish themselves in the American market, which they are doing, and they will also have to be able to sell weapon systems or services to countries outside of Europe. And, given the fact that the way that the world is situated with the number of autocratic regimes and the lesser number of democracies, yes, you will have that quandary, so to speak, also that choice. I mean, do we want to sell to this autocratic regime, or can we find some other way of supporting our national domestic arms industry?
I mean, do you think those moral issues are becoming greater now?
I think they have been great, also quite substantial for quite a while. I mean, you have developed the EU code of conduct on these issues. You have national domestic arms control regime when it comes to arms exports and so forth. But whether the arms industry is going to be less targeting autocratic regimes, I doubt it, actually. I hope that the moral issues will come even more to the forefront, but I'm a bit sceptical, unfortunately.
Hi, Daniel. This is Rob. I wondered if it goes hand in hand that the biggest arms producers are the most warmongering nations, or whether quite a lot of it is used as deterrent. Is there any way of telling that from the list?
Well, if you leave aside the term warmongering, if you look at the 10 biggest companies, seven of them are American. And if you look at the list as such, out of the 100 companies, 45 are American and 33 in Western Europe. So, I mean, it's an American, Western Europe-dominated list. The American market, or the U.S. market, is the biggest one. That's also one of the reasons why other companies who are not American want to get into on that market. And if you look at the kind of services that have been provided, they have been related to field operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. So you have a linkage there. Yes, I can certainly give you that.
Daniel, finally, just before we go, I'm just wondering if there's also, comfort in this list, in this era when, of course, so many foreign ministries, even defense departments around the world want to, really be showing that it's their softer side, which is, both carrot and stick in a way, and in an era where soft power is so fashionable that you can still look at this list, and yet you will see, peace-loving nations, including where you're sitting at the moment, Sweden ranking at number 31, with Saab. You can look across the border to, rather calm Norway, but Kongsberg Group in number 62, Patria in Finland, number 92, and up the list, neutral Switzerland with RUAG at number 84. Do you think it also allows certainly, some ministers and certainly people sort of looking for more peaceful platforms say, at the end of the day, everybody's at it?
Yeah, to some extent, as I look at the list, that will allow it. The reason why you have some smaller nations with substantial arms industry, often has to do with history, of course, a need of being self-reliant with regard to weapon systems and so forth. But yeah, certainly you have these industries also in nations which tend to have
a slightly different, foreign policy.
More moralistic foreign policy, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Another more.
Well, it makes a fascinating reading and even bedtime reading as well, because it's, I mean, as you go through this ranking, it is also quite extraordinary. Just also the number of everyday companies. I think from a pure consumer's point of view, I think a lot of people would be rather astounded by the size and scale of some of these players.
Yeah, and it's a thriving market. I mean, it's been an increase of 59% since 2002, which, of course, you know, well, if you compare it with some IT market, it might be not that much. But if you compare it with the GDP in the OECD country, that's at 11% since.
Yeah, and particularly at a time certainly where we're sitting, when you know all we hear about cuts in defence, you know, in the UK, but then you have a domestic player, of course, global player as well, like BAE Systems, which you know, which ranks number two on your list.
If you look at the US market, we don't foresee any reductions in arms procurement spending over the next couple of years. On the contrary, that's going to increase further, and that's the same in many other countries as well. Also because you have long production runs, you sign a contract, and it takes time to build the systems and deliver them. So in a way, the arms market, arms producing companies, are in a kind of a protected environment compared to some other industries.
Absolutely. Daniel Nord from CIPRI in Stockholm, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're up next with Culture. You're back with the Monocle Weekly, where it's time for Culture with Rob Bound and Steve Bloomfield and Andrew are going to join in as well. Just going back to our previous guest, when we were chatting to Daniel Nord from CIPRI, I was just looking at this 100 list, and maybe while you play the song, I want to try to figure out how many of these companies also make, you know, devices that can play CDs or, you know, transmit music and No, it's true though.
But you look got at, in there
on let me let's see. I'm just trying to let's see. Maple Hut. No, well, I mean, okay, General Electric. You know, bedside radios, right?
I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yep. General Electric is at number 18. Let's see, who else do we have here? We have, I was going to say Oshkosh, but those are not the ones who make overalls for small children. I think Oshkosh makes fire trucks or something like that. Mitsubishi.
From Blu-ray to Death Ray.
Exactly.
We need a sound effect for that.
Mitsubishi. Samsung, Kawasaki, who else? There'll be a few more. Go play a song, Rob.
I like it. You've got to be in it. You've got to be in it to win it, right?
You do. Samsung again.
buy a new hi-fi or else.
Yeah, what does Samsung Tech Win do, I wonder? Or Precision Cast Parts.
That's when you break your leg. Do you want to know what the song is? Are you going to? Do you want to read that out with a soundtrack behind it?
I want a marching theme with this.
A march. Okay. Do you want to know about this Australian band of youngsters?
It reminds me of the Teddy Club.
Not the Teddy Club.
It was an inside joke when we were in St Moritz.
The terrifying Teddy Club.
They have this at a very nice hotel in St Moritz. They've got a place that it's called the Teddy Club. Where you send your kids for the day.
Yeah. It is a joyless experience. It does sound desperately frightening.
It does. Anyway.
All the fun from the 1940s.
Exactly.
Do you want to know about Goldfields?
Yes.
They're a new band from Melbourne. There's five of them. They're all teenagers. This is the first thing they've come out of. They've literally only been in existence for 3 or 4 months, I understand.
Right.
Goldfields, not a great name, maybe. Makes me feel like, you know, the sort of dairies that supply milk only to corner shops.
Oh, yeah. Like there's kind of like random rogue dairies.
Yeah. Anyway, so they sound a bit like that. They do. The music sounds very good. This is their first ever song. It's called Treehouse. We lost our way. We almost wound up in Mexico, but who's to say?
I like that. It was Treehouse.
That's Treehouse by Goldfields.
Do they all look like Justin Bieber?
There's a picture of them here.
Let me see.
Look, they've got their coats on, as mentioned in the song.
Yes, they do.
No, they look like...
Oh, no, they're much cooler.
Yeah, they look quite cool. They look good.
And what about the rest of the album, or have you only heard this track?
This is the first thing they put out. It's just this track. They're working on their album. We'll play it. By the time they've had an album out, we'll have a radio station.
We will.
Don't you worry.
Okay,
it'll be fine.
I can't wait for your playlist.
Do I have to submit that? Shall I submit that to you?
Mm-hmm. Andrew's going to vet it, and then me.
Andrew.
Going back to our...
All the fun of the 1940s. Yeah, that's... He's going to throw it here.
I would throw my notebook, but I like my notebook too much.
My head's not that
hard. Are we coming to the end of an era? Because our Denon CD system has been very good to us for the last 5 years when we were at Boston Place. And now that we've moved to a new building, and there's been a lot of discussion about... We want to have something which can accommodate an iPod, but still the CDs.
We've slightly pilfered one. It's acting as a stand-in.
I saw that one.
I went to visit a hi-fi manufacturer.
Oh,
well-known
did you?
British hi-fi manufacturer.
Who's that?
Arcam.
Where are they?
And,
Do they actually still manufacture in this country?
Yeah, they do. They do a bit outside. Most of it's done in Cambridgeshire. And so I went to see them, and they've got quite a good one. They sent me one.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. You tell everybody that listens that
free,
I'm basically
free
trying
gift.
To nick it. It's
okay.
No gift.
I want to get the Yamaha one. Okay. The Yamaha, which is the... can still play a CD.
And it can launch rockets.
No, Yamaha...
like the Samsung one.
Yeah. No, yeah,
and
exactly.
You do your deliveries.
No,
the
Yamaha... No, I don't think Yamaha's on this list, actually. But I do want to know, there is one company called Fluor, F-L-U-O-R, American company. I think they make toothpaste. For all the servicemen.
Yeah, that's
what they do.
Toothpaste and bombs.
What about Chemring? What do you think they do? Is that for people with dysentery?
I think it might be. It's for Deli Belly.
It is.
It's just... it comes in tubes. Put it that way.
Fun with this list.
I know.
Days and days and days.
Good. And it all started with those... It all started with some whippersnappers from Melbourne. I like that.
It did.
Got a lot to answer for.
I know. We don't have to fill time on this program. We could just go to a break if we wanted to. Should we do that?
No, let's go on and on forever.
We're not sort of counting down at the top of the hour. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. This week sees the release of a new book offering a how-to guide to making your business, brand, and even yourself irresistible. Enchantment, The Art of Changing Hearts, Minds, and Actions is written by Guy Kawasaki, the former chief evangelist of Apple and a veteran entrepreneur. He joins us on the line from Silicon Valley in California. Hello, Guy.
Hello.
The starting point for this book, I noted that you grew up in Hawaii. I was in Honolulu recently, and when our producer brought the book up, I was wondering, had Guy been back to Hawaii recently? Because I sort of felt that maybe the starting point for this book could have been really sort of being rather disenchanted with the state of service in the United States.
Quite the contrary, really. The genesis of the book is because I've spent about 30 years trying to enchant people with various forms of technology, including Macintosh. And I wanted to get it all on paper for someone to, pass it on to the next generation so that when they create the next great gadget, the next great website, or the next great service, they would have a guidebook and they wouldn't have to, muddle through the darkness.
Mm. I mean, it certainly seems at the moment that there is something of a divide, and you sitting on one side of the Pacific, that there is, it strikes me there's an Asian way of enchanting. There's, you can sort of, move further across the globe, there's a European way, and then there's sort of the American notion of enchantment. And do you go into that, or do you think that, enchantment, as you define it, is universal? It doesn't matter who you're talking to. There's always going to be a few levers that you can pull.
I think it is closer to the latter, that is pretty much universal. I may have an Asian name, but I am, for all intents and purposes, an American. I was raised in Hawaii. The thing that is common, regardless of the culture, is that there are people and there are products and companies that enchant people, that delight people, that go beyond simply persuasion and sales and marketing and wooing and influence and all that stuff into a more delighted and delightful semi-permanent or permanent relationship. A very good case in point is, some computer companies may convince you to buy a computer from them. And then there's Apple. Apple enchants you, and you buy a Macintosh, an iPhone, iPod, iPad, iTunes, iBooks, you name it, and you stand in line 24 hours if you have to get the first one. that's the difference between enchantment and simple sales.
It's from certainly from even the marketing point of view of your book, there's a lot of chat about Apple, and obviously this is part of the provenance for you as well. Do you give us examples that go beyond the world of technology and others, going sector by sector? Because I think that's obviously, when you look at the consumer experience, can I find an airline? Can I find a hotel? And can I find a grocery store that also, if you love Apple or not, but as you define it, give you that same experience?
Yes, you could take Apple out of the equation and insert companies such as Virgin, and I think that is an airline that is all about likability. The three pillars of enchantment are likability, trustworthiness, and a great product or service. So I would identify Virgin as likability. I would identify Zappos as trustworthiness, where that company pays for shipping both ways if you don't like the shoe. And the company that is best identified with product or service is Apple. So, those are the three pillars. You need to have some element of all three, but every company has a different level of each. Mm. And those are three examples with three different emphasis.
Guys, Andrew here. I wanted to ask a question, which is, it seems a funny kind of thing to try and want to be enchanting. Enchanting often for me is in a brand or in a restaurant or in a shop you like or in a company you like. It's almost because they don't know that they're enchanting. There's something about it that's, they've kind of ignored all the rules. They're not very good at marketing, perhaps. There's something just naturally inherent in what they do that's charming, that kind of wins you over. It's their lack of knowledge about it. And I wonder if it's like a person saying, all right, my ambition, I'm going to be an enchanting person. Is it actually a good thing for brands to try and go out and try and covet this kind of quality?
Well, it depends on the sort of position that you're coming from. If this is today's fad that you've read a book about enchantment, so now you're going to be enchanting, and a decade ago you were going to be excellent, and a few years ago you were going to be built to last, and a few years ago you were going to cross the chasm, and then you were going to defeat the innovator's dilemma, I can see and understand your skepticism. I hope this is a more fundamental approach where, it's pretty aspirational to want to delight people, and I don't think that that's necessarily temporary nor a niche thing. I do understand what you're saying about sort of anti-marketing being good marketing, that the curmudgeon, that the non-slick person is enchanting. And I think the way to look at enchantment is to look at it sort of like fitness, where fitness is not a one or a zero. There are gradations of fitness, and everybody can become more fit, and you can also become less fit. So I'm just trying to help people move along the curve and become more enchanting. Not necessarily I'm going to turn little sow's ears into silk purses.
Guys, just before we go, let's say that the board has appointed someone who isn't particularly enchanting, but they're great with numbers, and I think there's no shortage of publicly traded companies, which they may not have a schmucky individual at the top, but they certainly don't have someone who's also cuddly and warm, and every customer would like to meet them. What would you say then? And I don't want you to sort of give a free consulting session, but maybe just part paid. What should every company get right? I mean, you can talk about the pillars that they have to do, but if you went into let's say people who've got it very very rough, like an airline. I mean, airlines, they can be as enchanting as you want, but listen, there's going to be forces beyond their control, snowstorms, air traffic control strikes, etc., that make Virgin Atlantic or Virgin America a not particularly enchanting experience.
Well, I think that people, there are outliers, of course, but the great majority of people do understand that if there is a snowstorm in London, there's not much Richard Branson can do about it. And whether you're Richard Branson or the CEO of, Cathay Pacific or of, Southwest Airlines, some things are out of your control. Now, but they're out of control for all the airlines. So the question becomes, what do you do if you are in this situation? And arguably, an enchanting airline would do better things. They would serve you drinks. They would make the Wi-Fi on board free because you're sitting on a tarmac and, you know, everybody's sitting there going crazy. Well, you know, what can we do? Well, let's open up Wi-Fi and make it free for them. Or, you know, put on a soccer match on the TV or play movies for free, you know, give headsets. I mean, there are things that they can do.
It's fascinating. And it, I guess, you know, I think particularly at a time, as you said, that there are a number of brands that that are doing things incredibly well. But I think it always becomes, I think, sort of the great debate at a magazine like Monocle, that we sort of look at a lot of what's being written about right now about ultimately service. And as you said, whether it's giving, you know, free Wi-Fi or free peanuts or free headsets, you know, a lot of it is about, you know, the ass falling out of the service industry in America as well, when you look across the Pacific and it's kind of going the other direction.
You mean going up in Asia?
Just where there is, you know, and that has to do with cost and everything else. But it's fascinating that that you're trying to, you know, offer some type of correction and enlightenment as much as enchantment.
Well, I must confess that if you had to say there are, you know, three airline markets, the U.S., Asia, and Europe, and if you had your druthers, which airline would you fly? I mean, you know, what part of the world? I have to say you probably pick Asia, right? Because the service level of Singapore and Cathay Pacific and their physical airplanes and their business class and first class lounges are just stupendous. I believe that the first class and business class lounges of airlines is a window into their souls. How's that?
Yeah, no, it's true. And also when you go to their head offices as well. Guy Kawasaki, thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. The book is Enchantment, The Art of Changing Hearts, Minds, and Actions. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're in London. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's almost time to say goodbye. But before that, it's also time for this week's monologue. This is Aisha Spears from New York.
February is not a kind month in New York. And for the fashion industry who migrate there for the Autumn Fashion Week, the city's ice-plated pavements and sub-zero winds are an unwelcome obstacle to negotiate as they tackle the jam-packed show schedule. Despite attempts to centralise proceedings at the Lincoln Center this time, the well-turned-out pack still found themselves scurrying to all corners of the city. The men's shows, squeezed into the start of the week, are increasingly marginalised next to the city's high-profile, celebrity-packed women's equivalents. This is odd, given there's been an explosion of American menswear labels over the past few years. Simon Spur, Robert Geller and Billy Reid, the recent recipient of the CFDA Award, are all garnering international recognition. But understandably, the biggest labels are showing their latest collections elsewhere. Calvin Klein, Tom Brown, and Philip Lim have sped up their production processes and spent the extra cash to show in Milan or Paris, where the men's shows take place earlier each season. Here, they are proper productions, not the lame sibling to the women's shows, as is the case in New York. The American fashion industry needs to find ways to keep its talent at home. Taking in the latest shows in New York, though, it isn't hard to see why Europe offers a more pleasant experience for all involved. Dominated by the buzz surrounding the peacocking and panic of women's shows, bad attitudes bleed into what could be a calmer experience in menswear. Self-important PR firms, armed with headsets and iPads, bark rudely at buyers and press. And while this month's blogger of the moment and tween TV stars from Gossip Girl have ferried into venues, everyone else is treated like cattle. Calls for an independent week of men's shows are rife. This needs careful planning, though. New York is not aligned with the global men's market calendar. By the time buyers battle their way through the city's shows, a lot of their budgets have been spent in Europe. The obvious thing to do would be to host a three-day event before the men's shows in Milan. The prime venues crowded with women's productions in February and September would be free, and the fashion crowd would love a transatlantic jaunt to look forward to first thing in the new year. Sitting in a number of partially empty men's shows like Rag & Bone, it became clear that US design talent is rife, but support for it is not. There are enough important American brands to fill a well-timed men's week. Now the city needs to market itself as an attractive place for buyers to cross the Atlantic. It's an opportunity that's ripe for the taking. For Monocle, I'm Aisha Spears.
Quite an extraordinary program that we can have a monologue on fashion weeks, and we can have a global ranking of the top 100 arms producers. We can have a cozy analysis about Libya.
We've done well.
Yeah.
And a book.
And a book.
And a book.
And
a record.
And a book by Guy Kawasaki.
Good grief.
And that's quite an interesting link, right? Because Kawasaki is on the 100, the 100 top arms producing company, and also he's a chirpy guy in Silicon Valley.
I know what he's. I know what he's selling.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What if he could sell enchantment to the arms industry?
But he could.
I think they're doing just fine, though, aren't they?
They seem to be doing all right.
Draw a smiley face on a bomb like they used to.
We're in London next week. Still,
you don't seem very happy about that. That'll be right.
But you're. I think you're heading to quite a big arms producing country. You're off to Turkey, I think.
Yes, we're looking at
fueling. We're fueling up the plane for Ankara at the moment. Where are you going?
I might be going to Serbia.
Oh,
yeah,
great.
We'll see.
Better you than me. and Rob, where are you off to?
I'll be hanging out near Paddington Street in the Malvern
cool.
area of London.
Are we happy with our new building? I mean, not happy yet.
I'm very happy. I like it a lot.
Yeah, but you don't have any. You don't have any shelves on top of your unit beside you yet, do you?
No. That's right. Everyone can see in.
I know.
That's right.
But it's good though.
It's good. We've got a lovely view of the park.
An amazing view of the park. Yeah.
Although Rob has been reunited with his lost, what do you call those things?
Drawers.
Drawers. He's found his drawers at last.
Eye drawers.
Yeah.
No?
That's a relief.
He misplaced them.
At least up until sort of, next Sunday. We're still in London anyway. That's all for this week's program. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills. Our sound engineer is who, everyone?
Sharpie.
Is it Sharpie?
He is. And if you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And of course, you can catch up with us on the Monocolumn. And you can also watch us on what TV network, Rob?
The Bloomberg Channel.
I think it's called Bloomberg Television, but the Bloomberg Channel.
You're the one back in the 1940s.
I was going to say, the Bloomberg Channel.
The Google section of the internet.
Be careful. Come on. Mayor Michael's going to call you next week. We're in London, as I said, but for now, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And I'm Robert Pan.
Goodbye.